right. We are going to continue our studies in Ecclesiastes. We'll be in the first 11 verses of Ecclesiastes this evening. Why don't we go, Lord, in prayer. Father, we thank you for this opportunity to be together. And as we look at this book that's very baffling in many ways, we pray you'd give us insights and understanding that we might better understand the text, but more importantly, Father, having understood that we might see its implications for our lives. And we do pray in Christ's name. Amen. Well, the book Ecclesiastes, we kind of last week looked at some various aspects of it. I want to just start and work our way through it now. In verse 1, we're given the title. It says, the words of the preacher, or if you have an NIV, it says the teacher. We talked about that word last week that it's one of these words that nobody really knows how to define, how to translate. So when you get a word like that, then the scholars, they just leave it untranslated, which doesn't help you at all. Historically, this concept of preacher came from, if you saw the audience as being religious, then that's where preacher came from. More if you saw it more from a secular standpoint, then it was used as teacher. I'm not really sure where the NIV comes into that standpoint, because I don't think they would fall into that, seeing it more secular. But I think it's maybe more just contemporary usage, because preacher takes on a totally different concept than just speaking to a religious audience. So I would think that's where it comes from. So it's, in that sense, it's being viewed in the translations as somebody that's instructing, in other words, which fits with the overall concept here. It says, the word of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. And it's from those two phrases there that has come the historical concept that this is Solomon that's writing. As we mentioned last week, there's a couple of things that bring that into a question, and modern scholarship is somewhat divided. Liberal is always, somewhere else, but even conservative scholarship is seeing this as that it possibly is not Solomon. But it doesn't really end up changing anything other than your reference. That historical reference saying, well, this was Solomon and this wise king, went out and did these things and wrote about it. The bottom line doesn't change it, but we'll operate off the idea that Solomon is the author here. And then it moves in and gives us the theme. And the theme is vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. The word here, literally, that's translated as vanity or meaningless, depending on your translation, literally refers to a breath or vapor, as we talked about last week. It's in that sense of, you're just breathing out and it just dissipates, it's gone. The New American Standard says vanity, and vanity, according to Webster's, means something that is vain, empty, or valueless. Now, in the more popular usage and more contemporary usage, vanity has that idea of pride, especially pride that that one has in themselves. They're in that sense of vain. But more of its basic meaning of the word is in that sense of empty or valueless, which is where the idea of vanity comes from, in the sense of pride. It's a puffed up pride. One is vain. They have this pride themselves that's not all that based on anything. Meaningless is the NIV's translation, and meaningless means, you got to love dictionaries, having no meaning, especially lacking any significance. So meaningless doesn't mean that, it's just totally empty, but it's lacking in significance. So depending on your translation, you're going to have vanity, you're going to have meaningless. They're both looking in this sense of saying that there's no real value. No real value or no real significance. Good question. I'll have to look that up. I don't think so, but it's a good question. I'm pretty sure it's not, because this word means, like I said, is this word for vapor. And so I don't think you'd be saying, don't take the Lord's name in a sense of vapor or transitoriness. But I would be pretty sure. Yeah, I would be pretty sure it's not the same, but how closely they're related, I'm not sure. But I'll check on that. One writer says it refers to what is without real substance. What's without substance? What's without significance? Thus, the idea that it's meaningless. And it's often intensified in Ecclesiastes, such as we have here, vanity of vanity, or meaningless of meaningless, or complete meaningless. You know, and so one way to intensify a word in Hebrew is to say it twice. Now, we seldom do that in English. There might be occasions, but and so we're looking at something that's really, really meaningless. If you say something is meaningless, but you want to say more, so you say it's completely meaningless. Well, you know, on the one hand, if it's meaningless, it's meaningless. You can't qualify it. You've already said it's meaningless, but to intensify that sense that we're talking about, you say it's completely meaningless. The interesting thing about this theme is there's nothing excluded from this judgment. He's not saying most things are meaningless, but here all is meaningless. All is without significance. Nothing has lasting value. That's a pretty, you know, pessimistic view of life. Nothing has lasting value. However, this perspective is limited or restricted, though it's not stated here. We'd see it later on. It's restricted in the sense that is under the sun. That is from the standpoint of living on earth, the focus, you know, kind of a horizontal life, then everything is meaningless. And that's the perspective that's just written. In the writing of Ecclesiastes, it doesn't embrace this concept that you could look up and there's God. It's looking at life horizontally. And so the conclusion is that from the authors, you know, Psalm saying that you can't find meaning in anybody or anything. And so that's where it's going. Well, he moves into the next few verses to support this theme. And the following verses basically become proofs of giving support that life cannot have any real and lasting meaning. Now, how would you like that to be your task? You know, you've made your statement that life has no real or lasting meaning, and now you're going to support it. Well, this is where he goes to support it. It begins with a rhetorical question in verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work, which he does under the sun? It's rhetorical in the sense that it's, you know, I mean, given what he's already said, there is, you know, the answer is obvious. There is no advantage. If you have NIV, you probably have the word gain, and this word means to gain or profit, and it's in the sense of an advantage or benefit. So what is your benefit? How do you benefit? What is the benefit that a man gains from his work? And the word for work here, and NIV has labor, but the word often carries this negative connotation of drudgery, of toil, of misery. So it's not looking at work in a positive sense here either. This sense of labor is associated with this idea of drudgery, of misery, of toil. So it's an idea of hard work. I mean, and so we can use it in ways that's positive when we talk about hard work, but it'd be maybe more in line with almost in the old perspective of people being in prison, you know, being sent to a punishment of hard labor, that, you know, this idea of breaking rocks. I mean, you know, so it's not, you know, the word doesn't mean that work doesn't have any value, but this particular association with this word is this sense of toil, of misery. So don't think of this, that he's necessarily talking about even, positive sense of work, but any kind of work, it really ends up, what is the advantage? What is the benefit? Which he does under the sun. And there we come to that phrase that we'll see often, that's looking at life horizontally. So when we say under the sun, we're talking about life on earth. What's done on earth? What advantage is there? And so he's saying there's none.
Is this in any way a commentary on the curse?
I would think, I don't know that this is, I don't think his statement is a commentary on it, but that's a good association. The perspective is the curse. In the sense that this is life on this horizontal plane, and there's nothing more. We live in this fallen world. Not that he's going to be theological and say that, but we live in this fallen world, and this is it. Apart from the fall, if you could theoretically, it'd only be theoretical. It doesn't even work, but theoretically, if there was no fall and you lived your life apart from God, it'd be meaningless. But that can only be, you can't even make that theoretical, because how could you live your life apart from God if you weren't in a relationship, And the only way you can not be in a relationship with Him is to have it severed by sin. The fall would come into play in the sense of that's where natural man is. That's where fallen man is. That's where unbelievers are. What gives me, we can talk about that, but what gives meaning to life for people in the world? What gives meaning to life? Anybody? What, chocolate? Yeah. You say that jokingly, but that becomes a major meaning in life. And if you extrapolate, what is he saying? Pleasure.
Some people would say work.
Okay. Work. So you have two? I'm sorry? Okay, so you got three things there if you're saying what gives meaning to life. One is the sense of pleasure, which can be extrapolated into many ways. It can go into hedonism, or it can go into extreme sports, trying to experience stuff, but you're talking about pleasure. The other one is work, and so there's some sense of producing something. And then the other one is relationships. And that would be, of those... from a Christian standpoint, which one's the most important of those three? We'd say relationships are the most important because they're eternal. But if you're talking about under the sun, what happens to the human relationships? They die. How futile is that? And what happens to the pleasures? You come to a point where you can't enjoy them, or you can't climb the mountain to ski down the mountain. And then what happens to work? You die, and whatever you produce, somebody else has it. That's the attitude, is it doesn't matter. It always ends up being useless and worthless with no value because you can't hold on to it. It's not going to continue. And so having that, then it moves into support this this theme by repetitive cycles, which show just how mundane life is. And so we have all these repetitive cycles. Look at verse 4. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. So we're talking about relationships. Well, here comes a group of people, and there goes a group of people. Here comes a group of people, and there goes a group of people. It just continues. When I was in seminary, Robin worked at a hospital, and that was a somewhat, unique hospital in that they didn't deliver babies. And, there's something nice about being in a hospital when somebody's really sick and or maybe somebody's dying, and you walk down to the nursery and you look in the window and you see these little babies. It's kind of like there's hope almost, even though you don't necessarily know any, right? Well, this hospital, there was no like that. So there was no cycle. It was just you died. No, they didn't bring anybody alive in that hospital. You just went there to die, I guess. In that sense of typical hospitals, then that's just, people die, people are born. People die, people are born. But it's just this ongoing, mundane cycle. And so, generation comes, generation goes. But the earth just remains. It just is. And it's this seamless cycles, these ceaseless cycles. Bob? There you go. And I guess those that disagree on certain issues with global warming say that there's this sinless cycle. It gets better and it gets worse. It gets better. So maybe we're no better than Solomon, huh? But look at verse 5. This endless cycle is illustrated by the sun. The sun illustrates the sense of an endless cycle. Also, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. I mean, as long as you've been alive, unless there was some reason you weren't able to see out that day or it was so cloudy you couldn't tell, the sun comes up and it goes across the sky and it goes down. The next day it starts all over. And it just goes and it goes. And it looks like something's happening, but nothing ever changes. It just keeps doing it over and over and over. The repetitive cycles of wind illustrate that nothing really changes. Verse 6, blowing toward the south, then turning toward the north, the wind continues, swirling along in its secular courses. The wind returns. So when the wind blows, there's this appearance that there's all this commotion, all this stuff's going on, but it just kind of goes wherever it goes, and then it's back again. And depending on what part of the world you live in, you experience a lot more wind than if you live in some other part of the world. And, you know, if you live in really windy places, sometimes you get to, it's like, where is it that the wind doesn't blow? That's where I live. And, But it's just these cycles. It's saying, you know, it just blows. It just blows and it blows and nothing's really ever changed by it. Now, you can say something's changed if you go up to some of these living sand dunes and you watch that they're always changing in that regard. But even there, it's just always changing. It's still always a sand dune. And so, the repetitive cycles of this wind just go on. And then there's the never-ending flow of rivers. And it also illustrates this cycle after cycle. All the rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place where rivers flow, there they flow again. NIV has a little different translation. They end up, you know, I mean, the translations aren't the same, obviously. They're different, but the meaning has not changed. New American Standard says, to the place where they flow, there they flow again. Just, it's looking at the destination. So, like, if you think of the Mississippi River and the Gulf, it flows there, and it flows there, and it just keeps flowing there. The NIV has more the idea that it flows there, and then it's an evaporation, and it comes back, and it rains, you know, up in Canada, and then it flows down the Gulf again, and it just... You know, but either way, it's the same point. There's this cycle. You know, the Mississippi keeps putting water out into the Gulf, but nothing changes. The Gulf doesn't fill up. And the river doesn't run dry. It just keeps going. The mundane aspect of life is captured in the pessimistic tone of the dullness of human existence in verse 8. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eyes is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. Think about that. I mean, you may get to that point where you say, I don't want to hear another word. But your ear never gets full. I mean, your brain may be on overload, and you say, I don't want to hear another word. You know, Robin told Megan when she was about 5 or something that she could only give her 3 ideas a day. She was wearing her out with all of her ideas. So you may get to that point where you're saying, you know, I don't want to take anything else in, but it's not because your ear simply is full and you can't get anything else in there. It's not that, you know, your eyes can't take anything else in. But yet, he says all these things are weary. It's just mundane. You can look back in history. And it confirms that nothing actually changes, he says. It all basically stays the same. That which has been is that which will be. And that which has been done is that which will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. He says, you know, You just look back and nothing really ever changes. Now, you know, you can get real specific and say, well, no, that's not the thing. You know, this is different from that. But, you know, we definitely live in a different time than this was written, and we do see what, you know, what we'd refer to as changes, and they happen rapidly. The things that have just happened in the last 100 years, incredible things that weren't before. But yet, there is a sense that those things just continue. I mean, even thinking when World War I was fought, it was ended up being titled The War to End All Wars. Because you look at what's coming out of the late 1800s, there was the sense of evolution was accepted. And going hand-to-hand with evolution, which is interesting in the religious world, was the movement of a post-millennialism. Now, post-millennialism, from a theological perspective, especially in its older form, was that the world will be Christianized. So in some sense, the world will get better because it's covered with Christians. And as Christians come in, and there's a sense of taking over almost. I'm making it a little more radical than it would ever be worded. But the world becomes Christianized, and then Christ returns. So he returns at the end of that millennium. The millennium on earth appears, and Christ returns at the end of it. So the world is getting better. That's going on religiously, and then over here in the science is evolution saying, you know, apart from the Messiah returning, the same thing, that everything is going to get better. And so both of these are going on in the late 1800s, and then you come to this world war. And so it's only logic to conclude this is the end of wars. We're going to get this straightened out and no more wars. And then you have World War II comes along, and it's devastating. Because there weren't supposed to be any more wars. And so you could even look at that and say, see, it just continues. It just continues. I mean, you know, not trying to be political here at all or make any kind of political statements, but following Vietnam, no one would have ever believed within 40 years the United States would be in a war that's lasted for, 6 years now. I'm not trying to make equations here. I'm just saying there's that sense that it keeps going. And that's what he's looking at here, saying it's just the same old, same old. That's his perspective as he looks at under the sun. It's very similar in the next one. And here it says, when you look around, it also confirms that the newest things are some form of the old. Is there anything of which one might say, see, that is new? Already it has existed for ages which were before us. Well, now, you know, sorry, Solomon, we can point to something. Like the TV, there wasn't any form of TV. Well, it depends how much you extrapolate that. Was there entertainment? Did people get on stage and entertain? There is that sense of refinement, and that seems to be the idea of what he would be saying here. That, you know, it's not that there wasn't something different, because there was, even with Solomon. I mean, there were different kinds of metals that were introduced. You know, their weaponry improved. But it's still a weapon. One could even say that, looking at an atomic bomb, is an explosive, and there was another explosive. But even before there were those kind of explosives, there were just other weapons. So that's probably in that sense, not in the idea that there is nothing. I remember the first time I heard this, and I wasn't a believer, and I was just like, that's just stupid. And somebody's going, well, it's in the Bible. I'm going, that's dumb. I mean, because you just go, well, this didn't exist before, so how can you say that? So he could not be saying that, and would not make sense here, but it wouldn't even make absolute sense in his time. I mean, inventions didn't come as quickly, but there still were those kinds of changes. But everything follows another. Somebody even said the idea of going to the moon. You basically have an explorer, and they're taking risk. And it's no different than, Lewis and Clark in that regard. I mean, it's different, but it's the same as, that. No different than, Columbus, getting on a ship to come here. Well, he wasn't even looking for here, but nevertheless. He was exploring. So that's that sense. Well, it comes to verse 11, and it really becomes the, in summary, that there's nothing really matters because nothing changes. No one can make an impact that's really an impact because nobody's ever going to remember it. So he says, there is no remembrance of earlier things and also of the later things which will occur. There will be for them no remembrance among those who come still later. Well, we definitely live in a time when, you know, history, in the sense of historians, you know, not only record history, but discover, you know, things that were recorded for. And so we do know a lot now about the past. There couldn't have been that much for Solomon to, in the sense of history, though there would have been things. But it really becomes who's remembered. And, I mean, there's that old thing of, you know, adage that the, you know, the winners, you know, write the history. And to some extent, you know, that becomes true. So who's remembered? But even in that sense, you know, we can talk about, well, you know, we know about George Washington. He's remembered. Abraham Lincoln's remembered. But, I cannot tell you the name of my grandparents. Now, some of you grew up with grandparents, and you know their names, but I saw them only a few times when I was young. I don't know my... You know, you go back to your great-grandparents. How far, you know, do you know your family history? I mean, so, yeah, we know about George Washington, but the people that really impact your life, do we know? So he's in that sense of saying it doesn't really matter. Nobody remembers it, and it doesn't change. It's a very interesting, good observation, Rob. I hadn't thought of that. Very good. So the very point of it, that's great. Well, you know, when we look at this message, this prologue, as he's introducing this, clearly you'd be asking, well, then why, you know, why am I spending my time looking at this? I mean, because it doesn't fit a Christian message. There is no hope here. There's only doom. So what is the significance of this? What does this do for us? Anything? By yourself, nothing's worth it. That's a good way to phrase it. You know, think about it. From a Christian life standpoint, when a Christian's life is meshed, you know, is not distinguishable from an unbeliever's life, what's going on with that person? How would you describe it? If you say, here's a Christian, his life cannot be distinguished from the unchristian. I'm sorry, Sally. Not making a difference. It's, you know, yeah. You look at that, and it would be that Christian has bought into the same horizontal view of life. So whatever you can make of life in horizontal is what life is. You know, and that's where that, I mentioned last week, that beer commercial, I don't think it's around anymore, I don't think I've seen it in ages, but the, you know, you only go around once, so what is it, get all the gusto you can, or something like that. Well, that's, from a horizontal viewpoint, that's exactly right. I mean, there could be, I don't know, that there would be a better theme in life. If this is what life is, then you have to figure out a way to enjoy life, because that's it. Now, if you enjoy it by working, or if you enjoy it by, you know, building into relationships, or you enjoy it by eating chocolate, that doesn't really matter. But that's what life is, because you only go around once, and then and you have to wonder about things like that. Do you realize how fatalistic and unmotivational? And you have to wonder, just that phrase, you only go around once. And so somebody says, I believe in reincarnation. Because that gives you hope. I don't go around once, I go around twice. Or I go around three times. I think those kinds of things have to come from that sense of that there is no hope. And to live without hope, I mean, there's a certain point where I don't think people really can function. You know, so you come up with something that's hope. I don't know where it necessarily came from. We're going to find it here. I don't know if it originates here. But it's that sense of if when you die that is the end of life, then have fun. Enjoy it. That's just another way of saying, you know, eat, drink, and be merry. Enjoy it. There, Larry Crabb, the Christian counselor, tells a story of a guy came into his office and he said, I want to be happy. Help me. I'm not happy. I want to be happy. Crabb said, well, I suggest you find two willing women and go to the Caribbean. He said, well, I thought you were a Christian. Well, you know what? He said, well, you gave the parameters. You said you wanted to be happy. You didn't say anything about God. You didn't say anything about, right now, tomorrow, I want to be happy. Well, if you put those kinds of horizontal things like, I want to be happy immediately, I want to be happy right now, then you're left in this under the sun. If we can think we can walk on the world's path and have a profound sense of meaning, then we're mistaken. Because you can only have a profound sense of meaning in the world if you come up with something that is inconsistent with the very things that they're stating. I mean, you have to come up with something that's significant that's not there. Francis Schaeffer wrote, Christians are called upon to be a demonstration at our point in history that the supernatural, the normally unseen world, does exist, and beyond that, God exists. I mean, how opposite of here. That our purpose is to be this living testimony that the horizontal is not all there is, that there's an unseen world, and that there's a God that exists. Colossians 3. Colossians 3, the first few verses says, therefore, if you've been raised up with Christ, keep seeking the things above where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your mind on the things above, not on the things that are on earth. For you have died and your life is hidden with Christ in God. When Christ, who is your life, is revealed, then you also will be revealed with Him in glory. Where are you going to set your mind? On the things above, not on things on earth. Are you going to have a vertical aspect of life, or is it simply horizontal? The life, and it would go back to really what Rob said at the beginning, this life on earth is designed in that sense, historically, originally designed to have God at the center. And then the fall comes. So life without God at the center, when it's not a theocentric life, God-centered life, then it becomes something else-centered. And whatever else centered it is, if it's pushed to its extreme, if you think through it to extreme, it becomes meaningless. Because even for us, we could say, contributing to a society, George Washington, I'm not trying to say he wasn't a believer or anything, but George Washington just lives on a human plane, and he gave his life and he did all this to invest in this nation. And you say, well, it had real meaning. It had real impact. Here we are a couple of years, 100 years later, and here's this nation. Now, I'm not a prophet, but if you look at history, you can be pretty certain that if you go far enough into the future, the United States, as we know it, will not be. And so that would ultimately become meaningless then. You invested your life to have impact, to have purpose for something that will exist, even if it exists for 1,000 years. it becomes meaningless. That's where it's going. But if you see life theocentric, if you see life as Schaefer was saying, our purpose is to demonstrate that there's something beyond the horizontal, that there's an unseen world, and that there's God, then it takes on a totally different shape. As we'll see over and over and over through Ecclesiastes, that Ecclesiastes is this book that is doing one thing. I mean, the message will always be the same. It's just getting there differently. The message will always be that life under the sun has no meaning. You have to get life above. You have to get an above perspective. So, if there's nothing that's lasting and real under the sun, then our only hope is to focus what's above the sun. So Colossians says, you know, don't focus here, but focus up there. I cited this Sunday, I like this quote. It says, by rightly relating to God in the here and now, we prepare for loving Him eternally in the hereafter. But that only comes if there's a different perspective. So Solomon is driving us to this sense of despair, because under the sun, nothing has meaning in and of itself. But look at all the meaning that comes to life when it's God-centered. Relationships all of a sudden have a totally different meaning. Your own work has a different meaning if God is centered. Pleasure has a different meaning. Even pleasure, C.S. Lewis in the Screwtape Letters says that, speaking of pleasures to Screwtape to Wormwood, says, our inventors, as hard as they work, not yet have not been able to produce one pleasure. So all we can do is take what is good, what the enemy made for them, and get them to use it in ways, in extremes that it wasn't designed. So, I mean, pleasure is God-created. So pleasure has meaning. Work has meaning, relationships have meaning, as long as it's God-centered. Well, any thoughts or comments or...